Tonight's theme is families, and speaking of families, actually stand up if you exchange gifts with family members over Christmas. Yeah, stand up. That's everybody. This is America. You may not want to, but you do it. Now stay up. Okay, so I want you to sit down if your gifts that you get tend to be normal. If most of the gifts from your family are reasonable gifts. Not everyone, but most of them are pretty reasonable. So the people who are still standing are the people that get weird gifts from your family members, right? Is that where, okay, cool. So what is the... I want to find out some of the weirdest shit that y'all have ever gotten. An electric toothbrush. That's pretty practical if you have bad teeth, right? Cool. Anything else? What else?
What?
I think we're going to go with this fellow right here. Sir, the library book man. Yeah, come up here. You're going to get this this incredible handmade Big Blue Door Jam sticker. Each of these are made individually on a laser printer for your own use. What's your name?
Zach.
Everyone give a big hand for Zach. Yeah, don't. If you peel it now, then what are you going to do with it? What are you giving people for Christmas this year?
Books.
Not from the library. I
bought them. Amazon, or do you do used books?
Yeah.
Yeah, check out some used books at least. Well. Okay. All right, Zach. Yeah, Zach. Yep. Yeah. All right. Now on to the actual stories, which first up, we have a couple people who, for family reasons, have to go early. So after this, the first two people, and then we'll be pulling names out of a hat for the rest of it. If any of you are interested in telling a story here in the future, please sign up. Our website is this. bigbluedoor.org. You can sign up there to tell stories for the next several months. We're looking for storytellers, and you can do what these people are doing. So first up, without any, this person is. We got a mix-up. This person is a cashier, scavenger, and artist. She has an upcoming gallery show at the Bridge in March. Put your hands together. First storyteller tonight, Terry Long.
Okay, all right. Wow. All right, how's this? Okay, we good? All right, so I've never been pregnant, but I have become a parent and caretaker to two beautiful girls who call me Terry. There's no Hallmark holiday for what I am, and it's not what I expected either. I started life in the Dwyer family, middle child of seven. Told everyone who would listen I was going to be a young mom, have kids before 30, not be old and gray like my mom. So I'm married at 24. And I'm ready for the baby making. Yeah. But first husband, he's not into family life the way I am. He sees having kids as a burden and a sacrifice. So I'm divorced at 28. And there is this farm boy. The sex was great. But, you know, the dating wasn't, you know, because I like him into shoes and libraries and galleries. And he's into being barefoot and hokey football. So I had contrived a plan. If neither of us were married by 30, we would get together and procreate. Yeah. Surely, you know, we're friends. We could, you know, get together and raise a child together. So I'm nearly 30, and I see an ad in The Hook. Anonymous egg donors needed. Must be between 21 and 30 years old. Non-smoker. In relatively good health. Yeah. This would work. If I couldn't have a child traditionally, I could give my eggs away. So the problem with this, two main problems, is the clinic screens for psych evaluation. And I'm like, okay, I've got therapy and medication like mostly behind me. And the other thing is I faint at the sign of blood. I faint when people even tell me about their surgery when they get a shot. And they're supposed to be weekly blood samples, self-administered injections, ending in anesthetized egg harvesting. But okay, fine. I'm going to do this. There's 8 pages of questions. So I decided to, you know, call up my mom and say, you know, discreetly get some history. Is there any background of breast cancer? How about genetics or birth defects? Why do you ask, Terry? So I'm awaiting the results. I get the letter. I'm afraid you've been rejected because of your genetic history. It's the kidneys. The fucking kidneys. Not even mine, because I have 2 kidneys. Apparently it's a big-ass deal to only have one, like my brother and my dad and my grandfather. Shit, I'm 30. I can't even give my eggs away. I let go of that farm boy fantasy. Yeah. It'd never work. We wouldn't agree on schools. You know, I'd want my child to have a private tandem friend's education, and he'd be like public. So I'm 31, and a coworker asked me to recommend a divorce lawyer. He's got 2 young daughters. I've often looked at their portrait up on the wall. They're wearing orange and blue raincoats, and they're standing in a natural light profile. So I recommend my lady lawyer and really, like, look at him for the first time. And so she becomes his lawyer. And then she's our lady lawyer. But first, a date or two, and I'm invited home to meet the twins for approval. I know, a tricky start to a relationship. Okay, he's legally separated and divorcing a woman, the Vortex, who finds out we are dating by breaking into the house, removing valuables, and taking a love letter that I'd given to him that he kept in the top drawer of his dresser. I hear my words read back to me in court by her lawyer, who's trying to prove him an unfit parent. I have to testify that I am not trying to replace her. So at 33, we marry. Our wedding portrait has Barry to my left and the Flower Girl twins in front of us. We take a family vacation to Ireland instead of a honeymoon. I mention adoption. I love the idea of us inviting some little soul into our lives, somebody to nurture. No, says Barry. If there to be more kids, he'd reverse the vasectomy. No, says Amanda. With spot-on foresight, she says, we shouldn't have more kids because it meant that she wouldn't get as much attention. You know, it didn't matter that I hadn't asked her opinion. She said it, and I heard it, and frankly, there was a lot of truth to it. Barry tells the story of holding the twins as preemie newborns in the palm of his hand, and they've been there ever since. He was dad and mom incarnate, did all the cooking, cleaning, caretaking while the Vortex partied. But they're growing older, and he still only had 2 hands, so I offered mine and took over, you know, groceries, laundry. He did homework. We tried to share the dinner, but they didn't prefer my cooking. We like the way dad makes it. But I was there, you know. I drove to the school after hours one night and begged the janitor to let me in, you know, because Emily lost her special blankie and she couldn't get to sleep without it. Mother's Day was painful. The Vortex insisted the world worship at the altar of M-O-M, and the days before and after were excruciating. I tried to concentrate on my own mom, you know, and all she did for me, and send nurturing Mother's Day cards to all the women I knew. One time I tried to run away from it. I went all the way to Omaha to see my sister. You know, surely I could be appreciated in the bosom of my family. It was loud and crazy at dinner, 7 of us all talking at once, and my nephew turned to me and said, you're not a real mom, are you? And I thought, you know, hey, real mom, not a real mom. Like, I know so many people who are nurturing wonderful parents but who aren't real moms. There's Harold down the street raising his grandson. I see him every Saturday at the soccer field. There's Our Lady Lawyer who's raising her niece and nephew. And so many other grandparents in our neighborhood actually signing the consent forms and showing up for the parent-teacher conferences. So I let it go. Who cares about a manufactured greeting card holiday? I know the twins love me, even if they're not allowed to say it. And I remember holding hands in Ireland. And I know we're the Long family because I've been writing it on birthday cards and Christmas packages for 13 years. July 26, 2012. We're empty nesters. Yes, Emily's graduated from college. The twins have started this group message text. It's awesome, really. A lot of, like, you know, hygiene references, plenty of pet photos, car repair questions. This night, Emily sends a text just to me.
I know this is bad timing, but I just wanted to say I really appreciate you. You've been so much more of a mom to Amanda and I than our blood mom, and I really appreciate it. I love you. Followed by, when you get a chance, can you email me your apple pie recipe?
Tell along, everybody. Yay! Woo! Yeah. The little sound you heard, you want to do that again? The little rattle? That means that what we have is a time limit, and it's a 8-minute time limit at 7 minutes, I think. They do a little rattle, and then 8 minutes they'll do another rattle, and so every minute after that, to just let them know that there's the time is sort of is running out. No. That we're not going to buzz anyone out of here, but just let people know that. And so if you hear the rattle and you're in the audience, the important thing is for everyone to immediately turn around and look at it so we can freak out whoever's telling a story. No, don't do that. Also, we have panels of judges, which we'll introduce a little bit later. What the judges do is they're going to pick some people. Each judging panel will pick three favorites, and the person who's voted on the most will get this incredible jar of Big Blue Door jam. So, speaking of storytellers, next up we have this fellow has a beautiful family who's partly here tonight and is the reason that he needs to go early. So, put your hands together for Sean Chandler, everybody.
Inevitably, in a conversation that goes on for a while with somebody, they'll find out that I was raised Jehovah's Witness. And they will get a little round-eyed and get this look. It's a mix of concern, apology, and just fear. And they'll ask me, how was that? And in my head, I think that they are thinking to themselves, he must have a really hard time figuring out who of his father's sister's wives is his actual biological mother. Or was he harmed escaping the compound? The truth of the matter is, my life was fairly normal. Aside from the not celebrating birthdays, not celebrating Christmas, spending Saturday mornings knocking on strangers' doors, offering to watch Tower and Awake instead of watching cartoons, my life was fairly normal. My family traveled a lot. Every summer, there was the annual trip with my mom's side of the family to the beach, which was sort of kind of like a circus that was three loose bolts away from losing their Ferris wheel. And the occasional trip to New England with my father's side of the family, which is how I became a Red Sox fan. You know, we had these camping trips with other families that were huge and amazing. We had family friends that were so close that you couldn't get away with anything. No matter when you thought you were hidden away, you would get busted for whatever you were doing that was not appropriate. There was these amazing fishing trips with my grandfathers and incredible cooking experiences with my grandmothers. So, all in all, my family life was pretty normal. Aside from, you know, not ever celebrating Christmas, which when you don't celebrate Christmas, you don't know what you're really missing. You're not losing out on anything. And aside from that, growing up a Jehovah's Witness, I was a Chandler. Which I always like to think of, if Jehovah's Witnesses were a mafia, the Chandler family would be kind of like the Sopranos. We weren't really the Corleones. We weren't that high up. But we still had clout. I remember this one time when my best friend Michael was getting married. I was living in North Carolina at the time. And I had to travel from the construction site that I was living in, come all the way up, head into Harrisonburg, stopped off on those places where you use the restroom and buy a bag of chips. A rest stop, thank you. To change clothes, which is kind of gross. But I changed clothes there, got into something somewhat respectable, arrived at the party. I must have looked at like somebody who just came out of the lower levels of hell fighting his way through to this party where everybody's immaculate. And this gentleman who was acting as pretty much the director of the feast comes across the dance floor, intercepts me, and is basically escorting me back out the door. This lady who's watching this entire process comes across the opposite side of the dance floor, comes over and says, "It's okay, he is Dave Chandler's son." This gentleman stops, turns, wide-eyed, looks at me. It's like, "Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize you're Brother Chandler's son. I am sorry. Please come in." My friends thought it was hysterical. I thought to myself that it was kind of sad that I wasn't my own person, but it was kind of funny. That being said, one thing said about my family that is true was something that someone had told my friend Michael. They had said this to Michael, that whatever happens to Sean is on his own shoulders because he has the best parents that anybody could offer. That is true. Dave and Jenny Chandler are like the kindest people you ever want to meet. Dave is perhaps one of the most intelligent people I've ever known in my life. And they were there from everything, from sickness to being bullied by people on the bus. They were always there for me. So, when the day came, and I will only qualify this by saying that I am no longer Jehovah's Witness. When the day came that I had to tell my parents that I was no longer a Jehovah's Witness, that I had been disfellowshipped, which is a term that my friends and I deemed as diffed because we wanted to sound cool. I told my parents that I was diffed. My dad took it a little bit better than I thought he would. I think he always assumed that I would come back to the fold. My mother, on the other hand, did not take it so well. She went white. I have never seen color drain from somebody's face the way it did with her. And then she ran the gamut of emotions. Denial. No, this can't be. That you're lying. To grief and self-blame of saying, "No, I'm sorry. This is my fault. I was a bad mother." To shock, which was pure silence, which I used that opportunity to make it for the door. I hugged my parents. I said goodbye. At that moment, my mom pulled herself back together and said, "Use this opportunity to get back together with your friends that have been disfellowshipped." I said, "Mom, aside from one or two of those people, I never liked them people when they were Jehovah's Witnesses." I made my way to the door and got out to my car. I was heading home to my apartment. And as I opened the door, the fourth emotion hit, and it was anger. Sean! Yeah? She will break your heart. And all of the others, too. That was in reference to my girlfriend at the time. I said, Mom, that's really has nothing to do with it. And I got in my car and I drove home with this mixed feeling of relief that something had been lifted from my shoulders and this hole this emptiness that I thought I would never have again until those two.
Sean Chandler, everybody. Never a gift in our book, no. Every person, when you tell the first time story, which I gave this to him surreptitiously, like in a Godfather's movie on the way out, you get a piece of crap little handmade keychain that I made myself. These are from an O-scale railroad, model railroad doors that I painted blue. So that's where they come from, you've been, I'm sure, wondering. But you get one of these if you tell a story up here. And speaking of telling a story up here, from now on it's random. And the next person, this person is a maintenance man at Innisfree Village, where he also is a resident with his three children and his wife. Speaking of family, that's a big one. Put your hands together for Tom Clay.
So I'm watching a video online of a man and a woman arm wrestling. They're fighting each other. And they're struggling. And they're grunting. The woman's using both hands against the man. Then she lets go. And the guy punches himself in the face and knocks himself on his ass. And it's hilarious. And I'm sitting there, I'm laughing. I hit replay and I watch it again. What are you doing? It's my wife at the door. She's looking at me. I'm watching this YouTube video. It's really funny. This husband and wife arm wrestling, and he punches himself in his face. I've become addicted to fail compilations. Marriage fails. Family portrait fails. There's all kinds of fails. You can watch how people screw up. It's hilarious. What are you doing? She says to me. Why are you so distant? What am I doing? What am I doing? See, when I was a little kid, I always wanted to be just like my Uncle Charlie. He had attitude. He was really cool. When my Nana was 19 years old, she had three kids, Charlie, Barbie, and Bobby, my dad. Charlie was just so cool. Pappy was an invalid. He was a cripple. He worked in a shoe factory. He was a glue man. But he got sick, and he lost a job. So Nana had to take a job as a switchboard operator. She could take baby Barbie and baby Bobby with her, but Charlie would run around and make a lot of noise, so she couldn't take him. So he had to go and live with the grim grandparents. It was supposed to be a temporary situation, but Pappy died, and it kind of became a permanent thing. He went through the rest of his life feeling that he was a victim. He'd been gypped. He'd been gypped out of his family, and he was owed. Many, many years later, when Nana died, the lawyer gathered the three kids together and said, "Your mother's will says that the estate is to be divided into equal thirds." "Equal thirds? I'm the eldest," says Charlie. "I'm the executor. I should get more." "Well, no, actually, your mother thought that you should get an equal third," the lawyer said. Oh, this made Char furious. He wasn't going to have that. Later that night, he drives his pickup truck over to the house. He's going to sort of take some stuff and rebalance the imbalance. But the lawyers had gotten there first, and they changed the locks on the door. This made him livid. So the next day they had the auction, and everything was sold. Almost everything was sold. Just the stuff that people didn't want was left over. Charlie got his third. He didn't talk to anybody the entire day. Later that night, him and his wife, Carol, they drive the pickup truck around to the house. They're going to take all the stuff that left over, the stuff nobody wanted. "This feels kind of weird," says Carol. "What?" "Well, it kind of feels like we're stealing." "Stealing? How do you steal your own stuff? This is my stuff. I'm the eldest. I'm the executor. This is my birthright." He puts all the stuff in the truck, and they drive away. They only made it a couple miles down the road, and Carol looks over. He's white. He's like, "I don't feel so good. What's the matter? I don't feel so good. I can't breathe. Well, I think you should drive the truck." So he makes her walk around, and he slides across the seat. She starts driving, and he says, "I don't think I'm going to make it." So she pulls into one of those little ambulance sump stations, and she runs in, and she says, "Help me, help me. My husband's having a heart attack." They rush out to the truck. It's a mess. He's vomited all over everything, and he's unconscious. They unload him from the truck. They put him in the ambulance. They take him to the hospital. It's serious. He's almost dead. They put him in a coma. They induce a coma, perform open heart surgery on him, save his life. After the 4 weeks is up, they bring him back. He's awake for about 2 weeks when my dad goes to visit. He says, "Hey, brother, how you doing?" Charlie just sits there, just stares at him, doesn't say anything. I say, "Hey, what's the matter with you?" "What's the matter with me?" Charlie says. "What's the matter with me?" He reaches over into the side table, pulls out a little notebook. "In 1979, you visited Mom 18 times. You visited me once. In 1984, you ordered pizza with Mom 6 times, never once offering to pay. I had pizza with Mom 10 times, and I paid every time." And that's when I realized, when I hear this story, Charlie's onto something. People say, you got to forgive and forget. But you know, we don't do that. We just forget. When I was 14, I hated my parents. I have no idea why I hated my parents. I've never forgiven them for it. I've just forgotten. And there's like this unspoken thing that's really awkward. And I feel like I should hate these people, but I don't know why. And Charlie knows. You keep a list. Stay organized. Don't let this shit go away. But the thing that I'm having a hard time with is the anger. See, Charlie uses these things to keep himself angry. There's a lot of people that use memories like this, not for anger. I mean, Hiroshima. They're never going to forget that. They're never going to forgive people for dropping a bomb on them like that. And yet they don't use their remembrance to hate Americans. Auschwitz. I know a lot of number people. They're never going to forget that. They're never going to forgive that. But they don't use this memory to hate Germans. Well, unfortunately, a lot of Americans, we don't forget things so that we can stay good and angry. Pearl Harbor. How many people know Americans who dislike Japanese people because of Pearl Harbor? How many Americans express extreme animosity towards Muslims because of 9/11? See, the thing is to let go of the anger, not to just forget about it. So when my wife says, "What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you?" I pull out my little mental notebook and I say, "In 2007, I told you I wasn't happy in this relationship. And you said, I'm perfectly fine with it. In 2008, I told you I felt alone in this relationship. And you said, maybe you need counseling or medication. She looked at me. She said, 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005. You forgot my birthday. Now I see. She's keeping her own list. You can't argue with that. I went back to the internet. She went back to bed. I sat there. I hear a noise and I look. And it's my son, my 10-year-old son. And he says, Papa, you don't read stories to us anymore. You used to read The Hobbit, Narnia, and The Odyssey. And you don't read that anymore. Why not? What's the matter? And I can see he's keeping his own list.
Tom Clay, everybody. Woo!
Garlic fries for Owen. Owen, who ordered the garlic fries? Come on, fess up. Who's Owen? Owen. You're Owen for those fries. Yeah. We have one more story, and then we're going to take a little break to let you order more drinks and more fries that you will hopefully claim in the future. But I want to let you know that we do this every month. We got another show in January, and you can check our website, bigbluedoor.org, to find out where it's going to be, because we're not quite sure actually yet. And also, we teach us classes in this. The next one will be in Tuesday, starting in January. So if you're interested in doing this, you don't have to take the class to do it. All you have to do is sign up. But if you want to take the class to make you feel more comfortable, just to think about it or analyze it or learn more about storytelling, you just don't want to. You want to do it more than just once a month, then you can sign up for that too. Again, bigbluedoor.org. Speaking of storytelling, wow. This next person, he was a drummer for the Hogwaller Ramblers and a director, sound designer at Live Arts. Three daughters, but now he knows what causes them, and he has seen a doctor about it. Put your hands together, Chris, first timer, Kristen Keithley.
I am speaking to you a little whacked out on both cold medicine and whiskey, so I'll have somewhat the same experience you are. I'm going to be listening to the story and hoping it turns out well. Also, one disclaimer, I do have to use the N-word in this story, and yes, I have to. But I am quoting somebody else, and I'm sure by the time we get there, you'll understand the context. All right. This is the story of my dad's funeral. But first he has to die, so this is 20 years ago, so we don't have to be all sad or anything, but it's interesting enough, so we'll go there. He was a very well-respected family practice and preventive medicine doctor in Houston, Texas, and was a great dad, loved him a lot. But he spent about a decade before the end of his life with prescription drug addictions, bad marriage problems. His mother died. He owned his own practice, and the finances were terrible. You know, lots of stresses. So one day, he just sort of bagged it, and he abandoned my mom, the practice, all the patients, and he hooked up with a business friend that I had introduced him to who was starting a longevity clinic in Cancun, Mexico, and became the medical director down there, took his receptionist with him pretty much overnight. So I get a phone call from my mom about this first, and then I hear from my dad about it about a month later, and he's doing great. He's off the drugs. He's working out every day. He loves it there and wants us to come visit, and I hang up the phone. I'm here in Charlottesville, and I'm thinking, this is really strange. And sure enough, within about 2 or 3 weeks later, I get the call that he's dead. Unfortunately, when he left my mom and his practice and his patients, he also hired a cheap lawyer in Houston to file for divorce. And he thought, well, you know, the lawyer can handle stuff while I'm in Mexico doing this thing. And he didn't show up for his, you know, divorce court hearing dates, and that he already looked kind of like a shitheel, so the judge didn't really like him to start with. And then when you don't show up for your court dates, you look worse. And so they handed down the judgment, and they mailed him the papers, and it wasn't favorable. He was pretty much, you know, inherited all the debt, and my mom got everything else. And so, as legend has it, he read the papers and was so upset that he went out and bought a bottle of vodka, drank nearly the entire thing, passed out, and choked on his own vomit in his sleep, which was absolutely the most rock star thing he ever did. But that's how he went. So, understandably, the family is like, what? You know, after this happening over a few short weeks. And I fly down to Houston to be with my mom for a few days before the funeral. And, of course, you know, she's going through her own level of what the fuck, because it's just, you know, it's unimaginable what she's going through. But, you know, I'm with her, and then we have to fly to Oklahoma, which is where all my extended family is, where I was born and everything else. And the day before the funeral, where I'm about to get on the plane, and my Uncle Jerry, who is my mom's brother, who is by far my favorite relative, he was a raging and impressive alcoholic. And, you know, after a lot of property damage and high-speed chases, he finally ended up in an assisted living situation that was happy for everybody, and he remains there to this day. But he calls me up. It was one of the most amazing phone calls of my life, it turned out to be, and so wise. And he says, you know, Kristen, I just want you to remember that this is your day. This is not about your dad. It may be about his memory. It may be about, you know, who he was to you and how much we all loved him or whatever, but this is for you. He's dead. He doesn't give a shit. This is for you. You do whatever you want. If you feel like screaming, if you feel like singing and dancing, if you feel like taking all your clothes off and running down the street, if you feel like telling everybody to go fuck themselves and do whatever the fuck you want, you do that. This is for you. You're his only child. He's gone. This is your day. I'm thinking, well, you know, you're fucking nuts. But yeah, you're absolutely right. That's really true. And of course, but you know, that's all fine and good, and everything's going to go fine, and it'll be sad. But thanks, Uncle Jerry, for that, and appreciate it. And left it at that. And so we fly to Oklahoma, and it's the night before the funeral, and we're staying at my mom's sister's house, and I'm sitting there, I'm wondering, who's with Grandpa? Because Grandma was gone, and the rest of the family was nuts. And so I asked about him. It was like, is anybody staying with Grandpa tonight? And no. My dad's dad is alone. He just lost his eldest son. He's alone in his house. And I said, this isn't right. And so I looked at my Uncle Glenn. I said, can I have your Mercedes? He's like, shit, yeah. And he gives me the keys. And I drive from Ada, Oklahoma to Shawnee, Oklahoma, which is where I was born in my dad's childhood home. And also where Brad Pitt was born. And our lives diverged dramatically after that. But so I drive there, and I surprise him. I knock on the door, and he's obviously been, you know, awake and asleep at random throughout the day. His hair's all messed up, and he's just like, his face fills up with joy. He's so happy to see me. He hadn't seen me in probably 5 years. And we exchange this huge bear hug, and he welcomes me in. And the last time I'd been there with him alone, I'd flown down from Michigan when I was 11 to visit family, and I was there with my grandpa by myself, and we stayed up till 4 in the morning, and he chain-smoked and drank teacher scotch while I drank at least 7 grape sodas. And he told me all the family stories going back to when he was, you know, his great-grandfather, and I knew everything about our family history. One of the most memorable nights of my life. So I'm sitting here like, all right, I'm alone with Grandpa again, but I'm of age. This is awesome. So he brings me back to the kitchen. He's like, what can I get you to eat? You know, and he starts hauling out lunch meat and bread, whatever he's got in the fridge. And I'm like, you know, I'm not really hungry. It's okay. And so we just hang out. We don't talk about my dad at all. He doesn't ask about my dad. We don't talk about feelings about my dad. He asks about me. I talk about my life, you know, how school went, what I'm doing, job prospects, everything. He don't want to talk about it. This is a man who outlived his own wife, And his eldest, he had four kids. His eldest daughter went crazy in her 20s, wrote a bunch of bad checks, went to jail, you know, in and out of jail, and then divorced her abusive ex-military husband to marry a guy that lived off the state because he had the mental capacity of a 13-year-old and couldn't take care of himself. And then that was the oldest daughter. And then there's my dad, and we knew what happened to him. And then the middle son, Melvin, had blown his brains out 8 years earlier after getting out of the Marines in that very house that we were in. And then the youngest son, James, a psychologist. Okay, he was a psychologist, but he was a psychologist working for the Catholic Church within the Oklahoma penitentiary system. And that's a level of fucked upness that, like, it rivals Inception to me in my mind. But to make it worse, he and his wife were hoarders in their spare time. So we end our evening about, you know, 1 in the morning, we go to bed. And so the next day, and I'm sorry it's going to be a little long, but it'll be worth it, I promise. The next day we get to family arrives, and we go to the church, this childhood church where my dad went when he was a kid. My grandfather probably hadn't been in, you know, 50 years. And it's just family because it was too far away for any friends to come. And so it's just family and church ladies, you know, the people making sure the flowers are all in the right place and all that stuff. And so the ceremony begins, and it begins with music. And I'm a musician and have been accused of being a musical snob, but this violated every standard and principle I had ever even heard anyone having, even, you know, ABBA and Spice Girl fans, I don't know. Organist, flautist, violin player, and they're all playing together. They obviously had never even spoken on the phone, let alone rehearsed together. They're not in tune. They're playing standards like, you know, Bringing in the Sheaves, Amazing Grace, all the, you know, the stuff you've heard a million times. It's not in tune. There's wrong notes all over the place. And I'm sitting there, and I start to snicker myself. I'm remembering Uncle Jerry's phone call, like, oh, you know, this is my day. This is my day. And this sucks. This is not honoring my dad's memory. This is not entertaining. This is not reverent. This is bullshit. I would, you know, let's get on. And so I decide I'm stopping it. You know, we're in the middle of Amazing Grace and it sounds like hell. I'm ready to just, you know, get out of this church anyway. So I put my hand in front of me on the pew and I start to stand up and I'm going to politely say, excuse me, we just need to stop now. We just need to stop the music and I'd like to get on with the service part of it. And I'm sorry for interrupting, but thank you. As I'm standing up, my grandfather on the other side of the church stands up before I could say anything, and he goes, this, just like this. Get me out of here! I am not sitting through another goddamn funeral! Take me home! The music stops, everybody turns and looks. My uncle, the Catholic psychologist hoarder, stands up and does the exact sensible thing, puts his arms on my grandfather and says, it's okay, Pop. I'll take you home. I'll chat. They leave, and I swear to God, the minister gets up and starts into this kind of thing. We all understand his pain, his inability to face the pain of losing a child, something we cannot understand, but it's nothing compared to the pain of the fire and brimstone that we're all going to experience if we don't find Jesus. I swear to God, he went there. He went there. And so I'm reliving this all over again. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to have to stand up and stop this part of it. This is terrible. This is not what, I mean, these people don't even know my dad. This has nothing to do with my dad anymore. And then I decided, no, I'm not going to do it because I don't want my family to, in one afternoon, have the reputation of interrupting church services in Shawnee, Oklahoma. So I stick to my reputation of, you know, being a guy that almost does something cool all the time. So we go to the grave site, and it's sad, and I tell a poem, and, you know, and people cry. And we come back to my grandfather's house where the reception is supposed to be. And I walk into the kitchen. Everybody else goes in the front door. I come in the back, and there's my grandfather and his older brother. My grandfather's 80. My great uncle, DV, I don't know what it stood for, is 82, and they are sitting at the kitchen table drinking scotch and have been all afternoon, obviously. And I walk in on this line. And that's when she looked at him and said, "That's why you're a moron and will never amount to anything." And my grandfather just goes, and laughs exactly like that, with a cigarette in his hand, scotch in the other. And they've been doing this all afternoon. And the church ladies are back there trying to get the finger sandwiches and the vegetable trays together and trying to breathe, you know, because it's just full of cigarette smoke. And I look at these two and I think, you know, they spent the whole afternoon reminiscing, lifting each other up, remembering stuff, remembering good things about each other, and they're happier than anybody else walking into this house. And it just taught me such a huge lesson about being in the moment that I won't go into now. But anyway, so the rest of the evening, these guys keep drinking. Everybody else is in the front of the house, and I mingle with old med school buddies of my dad and family that showed up, and it lingers on. And about, you know, 7, 8 o'clock, Uncle DV and my grandfather disappear into the bedroom because they've had enough and need to pass out. And I spend, you know, the next couple hours with the rest of the family, and I decide I'm going to stay there again tonight. So everybody clears out, and my mom leaves with my sister and cousins, and they go back to Ada. And I'm sitting in the kitchen at about 9:30 all by myself with scotch and cigarettes and just sitting there by myself. And I don't even know what I thought about. I thought about my dad, I'm sure. You know, I just thought about my dad and everything that was going on. And then about 11 o'clock, the light comes on under the door. And I'm like, oh, good, they're awake. You know, I'm going to hang out with these two. I'm glad they're back awake. And so I knock on the door and I'm like, yeah, come in. And so I open it up, and they're on twin beds head-to-head sitting there, and they've turned on the TV, and they're rubbing their eyes and getting themselves together, and Uncle DV puts on his glasses, which are, I swear, a half an inch thick. The kind of glasses, like, you could only see his eyes if you looked right at him, and then they were like this. Otherwise, you couldn't see him. And he was actually legally blind, I was later told, but he would still drive from town to town with some sort of advanced shape recognition. I don't know how he did it. And so Saturday Night Live is on, and you have to follow me here a little bit. This is 1992, and the movie Dave has come out. Dave was, it starred Kevin Kline impersonating the president, was the premise of this movie. I never saw it. And Kevin Kline is the guest host, so he's supposed to be giving the opening monologue for Saturday Night Live. As a play on the joke, Kevin Nealon, the Saturday Night Live regular, is doing the opening monologue as Kevin Kline, pretending to be Kevin Kline. It's very funny. They don't get it at all, but, you know, they're still laughing along with it. And so Kevin Nealon, as Kevin Kline, introduces the special musical guest, which for the evening was Willie Nelson. He introduces Willie Nelson, and out walks Chris Rock. Everyone knows who Chris Rock is? Okay, he's wearing torn jeans and a bandana and a wig and a fake beard and mustache with a guitar slung over his back, pretending to be Willie Nelson. And I'm laughing at this. It's cute. It's funny. Nice shtick. My Uncle DV, through his half-inch glasses, pays attention for a second, and he goes, in all seriousness, "Hey, look, there's Willie Nelson dressed up like a nigger." And those two start laughing it up, and they have no idea how funny that is. And I let it sink in how funny that is. And maybe on your way home, a few of you, it will sink in how funny that is. But so my father's funeral ended with one of the biggest laughs I will ever have in my life. And thanks for listening.
I want to introduce our judging teams. What they do is, to be a judging team, all you have to do is come early with a friend or two, and then you can be a team. And we give you a little sheet, and you just figure out your three favorite people. And you circle their names, and just be careful of this cord, but you're welcome to sit there. Don't strangle yourself with it. Don't trip. The people, the winners of the big blue, in addition to the jar of jam, which is priceless in and of itself, You also, if you are a winner of one of these shows, get to come back and be part of our Big Blue Door Slam, which has not been scheduled yet, but which will be another event that will be like this, but different. So first, who's our first our group over here? What are you? What's your team name? Makaji. Team Makaji. Woo! I see a ballot here. What's your name? Team name? Team Wizard? Wizard! Whoa! Yay! And over here? Hurricane Hermione. Awesome. Yay! That's fantastic. The Shakespeare reference, and among other things. So these people are judges, so if you don't like it at the end, then blame them. No, don't do that. One of these teams, some of the people have taken the true storytelling class, which again is starting in January. You don't have to take the class to do this. Mostly what we do in the class is work on developing a body of stories. So you take the class, you end up with about 8 different stories of your own that you could then, and then we polish one of them to actually tell. You don't do it here, but you do it in a regular thing. There's also, I'm teaching some improv classes through Live Arts, which will be also starting in January. You can navigate their very thick website to try to find it there, or you can look at bigbluedoor.org. But enough about me, enough about bigbluedoor.org. Time for a story about families. Yay! The next person is improviser with Bent Theater and a career counselor at the McIntyre School of Commerce. Put your hands together for Aaron Gilley!
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Can you hear me? All right, great. So family as a preference is not that important to me. Not to sound like someone who might live in the neighborhood around here, but like all the world's my family kind of thing. Like that's how I see it. Like my family of origin does not hold such a strong a relationship to me as a lot of people. We get along great. And we have a lot of fun together, and we like each other, and we do anything for each other. But in terms of the interdependence, like, you know, you do things as a family, or these are the family norms, nada. That does not exist. I'm okay with it. And so being married to someone whose family is like this, like if I could hold my hands tighter, I would. Like if we could all hug together, that's what their family system is like. And so it's almost diametrically opposed how, you know, we're very, you know, loosely connected, and they're very tight-knit. And so the academician, or the academic in me, likes to analyze things, especially as a therapist background. I like to analyze things and analyze systems. And I came to the conclusion that no matter how you view your connection to your family, seemingly you do learn from them. Your family of origin or your backgrounds, you do learn from it, either by osmosis or by what people tell you, oh, your family did this. So you can't really escape family influence to a certain degree, even if it's not something that you're as connected to. So that being said, that's where I've been in my head as I've thought about this concept of family, you know. And so I thought to myself, what's something for my family? If I was to do some sort of sociological study, someone like Jane Goodall or someone was to watch my family, at what point would she have found a snippet of my family to really get an overlay of what the family was really like? You know, where's that one sort of a random sampling, or not so random sampling, as it were, where you would see what the Gilley family was really like the values that they would have instilled, the stories that they would have told, and how they formed people around them. And so also another story taking place in 1992, much like the story 20 years ago, my family decided to take an impromptu trip to Kansas. I grew up in East Tennessee, and at that point I was 9 years old, and as a 9-year old, even if you have like jet setter parents, just a random trip 900 miles away isn't something that's very common, I would imagine. And they decided to take a trip to Kansas. They said, oh, tomorrow, pack your clothes, clear your calendar, we're driving to Kansas. Okay. And I thought to myself, this would be a great idea for a story because it starts to contain the snippets of the things that I would say, this is what I got from my family 20 years later. The idea that you would take an impromptu trip to Kansas is something that my parents would do, not necessarily because it's spontaneous, that, which is sort of the more maybe positive, if you're looking at the connotation of this, you know, spontaneous is a nice positive word. The flip side of that is it's just last minute. There's spontaneity, then there's, oh yeah, we forgot to tell you this. That was more of that kind. This theme is something my family's known for. Things that I've learned at the last minute from my mother. Your cousin's getting married tomorrow. Okay. Your cousin's getting divorced. Your cat, I hope you're having a good time in college. Your cat died. Also, your grandma has cancer. Your father lost his job, or your father's going to lose his job, so he's going to retire early. Some seemingly jovial things, some very tragic. Things that come about last minute, told to you when you're thinking, this could have come to my attention yesterday. The theme of my family's communication style. And so we decided to go to Kansas. Actually, my uncle lived there, so it wasn't completely random. It's not like they threw a dart at a map or spun the atlas around and picked somewhere. And so we decided to fit the five of us, my parents, myself, my younger sibling, and my grandmother, and my parents' tiny Cavalier, forced uncomfort, another family trait that my family was very good at. And we made the trip to Kansas. From Johnson City, Tennessee to Olathe, Kansas is 13 and a half hours, give or take, according to Google Maps. We turned that trip, which you could conceivably do in a day. I'm sure a lot of you have probably driven, you know, more than 12 hours in one day. It's not inhuman. But we decided to turn that into a two-day trip, and which is actually a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. We stopped in the most arcane, like just crazy places. From Johnson City to Nashville is about 5 hours. We stopped like a dozen times in the most random places. From Nashville to the next stop, Paducah, Kentucky, 3-hour drive took us like 6 hours. We stopped at a place called Redneck Land. It's actually called Redneck Land, like, which sounds like a pejorative thing you would say if you're driving through there, like, oh, fuck, this is Redneck Land. That was the name of the actual place. It was the given name for this location. And we had great times there. And even just, you know, and I was nine, just having a good time with my family doing this. Then to Mount Vernon, Illinois is the next big stop, then to St. Louis, then to Kansas. Finally, in about 2.5 days, we made it there. And once we got there, we had no agenda. Sort of lesson just two or three we're on is that it's really more, and this sounds so cliche, and I'm sorry, but it really is more about the journey than the destination, which I know is probably in a dozen songs, several dozen Hallmark cards, probably in someone's wedding vows in this room. But it really was that part. And that's something really beautiful that my parents did teach us, is that, you know, if you have places to go, enjoy your time getting there. Which really is a beautiful thing. It's fun to explore the world. Stop at places like Redneck Land. Don't just worry about getting to your destination, which is very enjoyable. On the way back from Kansas, we took an alternate, even more alternate route. If you'd believe that there was a more alternate route than the way we went, instead of going back the way we came, let's drive south from Kansas into where we went through was through Missouri and into Arkansas. Going through the Ozarks, going to Ozark Land, which is an actual place, not too unsimilar or different than Redneck Land or Hillbilly Land or wherever we went earlier. Ozark Land was very fun. And we were just left to our own devices. Our parents gave my brother and I a sense of trust that we have got you here. Yeah, you're here. We trust that you will make the right decisions, that you will use your faculties, use what's been given to you, and enjoy yourselves. And as I roll towards 30 in a few months, I see that's something I've still been able to do. Then maybe some of these latent messages from my family were purposeful. They weren't just random happenings. They were things that came about because they wanted us to have this ability to be independent. So now that I stand here at going on 30, I think of this interdependence as the least important value I have as a person. It's like, is this some sort of weird, maybe not ironic, but odd value that my family gave to me, that they loved us so much, that they cared about us so much, that the most important thing they could do for us was to teach us not to need them, not to be too deep or philosophical. But at this point in my life now, I think, wow, my mom and dad are pretty smart. And I appreciate them giving these values and these lessons. And it was kind of cool to think about how, wow, what sort of a seemingly random trip kind of contained all these things that my parents are hoping to do. They could have told us these things verbally over the course of our lifetime, over our adolescence, by a direct message. But some chance that they all decided to do it in one trip to Kansas. It was really fun, and I hope that my kids one day can do the same. Thank you.
Aaron Gill, everybody. Woo. This next person is a painter. Currently basing paintings on old family photos. And his wife has a show at WVTF on Water Street on January 4th. Put your hands together for Matt Clabin!
Story starts at 5:30 in the morning. I'm in the garage apartment above my grandmother's house. I wake up, I fix myself a bowl of Count Chocula, and I drink a can of Dr. Pepper. I put on a pair of jeans and a pair of boots, and I take a handful of triple action, extra strength, Gold Bond, and I pack it in my butt because, as a sweat buffer, because this is July in South Texas, and in a few hours it'll be 113 degrees outside. I hop in the 1984 Suburban, customized with gun scabbards on each side, because this is Texas, and I head out towards the Creek Barn. And on the way to the barn, I pass the main house at ranch headquarters, this beautiful Spanish-style hacienda. And inside this ranch headquarters house is a fabulous dining room. And in that room is a immaculate banquet table. And on this banquet table, as centerpieces, are the three trophies of the Triple Crown, the Kentucky Derby, the Belmont, the Preakness, won by the famed horse Assault in 1946, who was born and raised and trained on the King Ranch, which is a ranch that my family has owned and operated for seven generations. In 1853, my great-great-great-grandfather, Captain Richard King, left the steamboat trade and started buying up land in the Wild Horse Desert, the southern tip of Texas, which is this sort of harsh wasteland that he envisioned as a cattle ranch. And within a few generations, this small enterprise had developed into a true empire. The way of American ranching was born down there. The American cowboy was born there. The quarter horse was in part developed down there. All my ancestors were ranchers. My grandfather was a renowned horseman. My father rode horses before he could walk. And I, too, I've grown up working on the summers in my teens. And this is one such summer. And usually I've worked in sort of cow-calf units. But this summer, I'm working with the Creek Barn, which is the colt division. And I'm from the city, but I'm family. So I get the job whether I'm qualified or not. And the real cowboys sort of tolerate my presence. And the Creek Barn is where all the horses are trained on the ranch. And it's also where the horse cemetery is. It's where the legendary ranch horses, Mr. San Pepe and Little Pepe and Pepe San Badger, have all and all of their kin, all the other peps, have been laid to rest. So about 6 in the morning, I pull up to the barn, and I meet up with the rest of the colt unit. And I'm met by my boss, Cody Kreider, who's he's a red-headed cowboy, kind of a smiley man, originally from Montana with a big, bushy red mustache that covers most of his face. And he just is a guy that loves horses. And then there's Tom Williams, who's an ex-rodeo cowboy who left the arena for a safer livelihood. I asked him once about his bull riding days, if he had any stories. He said, well, yeah, I had a good one early on in my career. I was
I was down in Laredo, and I drew a rank bull. He come out the gate and slung me down hard and stomped right on my face. And when I came to, I was in the hospital. And apparently the bastard flattened me out pretty good, because the doctor had to rebuild my face and stuff 20 foot of gauze up in each one of my sinuses. And after about a week of doing nothing, getting tired of twiddling my thumbs, I decided to pull the gauze out myself. I got a pair of doctor's pliers and ripped them out. Yep, a bunch of black shit spilled out with them, but after that I was all right. So these are my coworkers. I'm supposed to do what they do. But there's lots of differences, but there's one main difference between me and them, and the main difference is I'm afraid of horses. That's not a joke. As a kid, someone told me that if you walked around the backside of a horse, it would kick you in the teeth. And I took that to heart, and I just assumed that every horse had it out for me. So back at the barn this morning, Cody walks up and says, "Hey, Matt, why don't you take old Watermelon out for a spin?" And I'm not excited about this. Watermelon is a young horse who has been ridden 3 or 4 times tops. And most horses, when they're getting used to the saddle, are really skittish. So I catch Watermelon and put a bit and bridle on and put the saddle blanket on very gingerly and put the saddle on very gingerly and climb aboard very gingerly. And neither of us are very happy about the situation. And so we go out, and I'm supposed to work her around in tight figure eights, teaching her how to follow my directions. And we sort of manage a squiggly line. I'm not very good at the horse training thing. And it's hot, and we're pissed off at each other. And I'm clamping my legs spastically, trying to get her to go this way or that. And she's about fed up. And she can sense my frustration and my fear and my weakness and my stupidity. And with one last clamp of my legs, she decides we're done with today's lesson. And she takes off like a bullet out of a gun. I lose all control. I grab onto the saddle horn, and she takes off full speed in the direction of the cemetery. And at the gate, either turning right or turning left, she chooses neither and starts bucking. And I decide I'm not going to fall off. I'm not going to get my face stomped in. And I'm a cowboy, damn it. And so I'm holding on, and I'm clutching for dear life, and I'm like Helen Hunt in Twister holding onto the pipes as the tornado comes and sucks the bridge up over her. And that's about the time that the ranch tour bus pulls around. These buses cart cowboy files and Asian men who collect Western memorabilia and wear bolos and cowboy hats. They take them around for historic tours of the ranch to take pictures and maybe see a real-life cowboy in action. And so they pull up to the cemetery to take a picture of Mr. San Pepe's grave. And there's me in the background being jerked around like an idiot. And you can just hear, I can hear on the megaphone, the tour guide saying, "Well, folks, quite a treat today. We see a young Clayburg, one of King Ranch's own, carrying on the family torch, a true living legacy." And oh, John Wayne's son, and the cameras are flashing. And that's about the moment that Watermelon hits the ejector button, and I catapult through the air, losing my grip, arms flailing and eyes bulging, and the cameras are flashing, and I land, boom, right on my back. And all the air is compressed out of my lungs, and I'm squirming for breath. And the bus driver, embarrassed for me, drives off, and the colt sort of saunters back to the corral, and the legacy lives on. And a few weeks later, a new guy shows up at the barn, a guy named Mondo, and he is a Mormon guy from Utah, and he's trying to marry the division manager's daughter. And this division manager gave him the job to see if this guy could work for it. And he's like me. He doesn't have very much experience ranching. He's done some pig farming. None with horses. he's working very hard for approval. He's been given this job by some outside special arrangement, not by some basis of merit. And we really identify with each other. And Mondo is working a colt that Tom Williams, the bull rider, had started. And it's a great-looking two-year-old who's taken really well to training. And this is the first day that this horse will feel a saddle. And Mondo takes the colt into the circle pins, and I don't have much to do myself, so I climb up on top of the pins and watch, like stadium seating. And Mondo trots the colt around for a while to burn off any nervous energy and ties her up to one of the slats of the pins. And when the horse feels the weight of a saddle, they usually are pretty, when they're young, they can recoil, and it's not very comfortable. So you tie the rope up very short and about head height so it can't thrash around. And so Mondo, and I'm taking note because I haven't done this yet myself. So Mondo picks up the saddle and he lifts it up and he throws it maybe a little abruptly. But the moment the colt feels the pressure of the saddle, she rears back, throwing her head up, and tips back. The knot holds, but it's the wrong knot, and it fails. And her momentum carries hers back. And she sits down, crunching hard on her haunches, with a crack as her pelvis breaks in half. And I can hear it as clear as day. And the horse kind of slumps off to the side, stunned, and is pawing in the dust, and her back legs are paralyzed, and she's turning slow circles, and Mondo is in a daze, and the paralysis sort of spreads up through the horse's spine and neck, and Tom and Cody run up. They heard the crack, and they've already called the vet, and in a few minutes, the vet shows up and doesn't say a word, just gets a double dose of heavy anesthetic into the horse's jugular, which stops its heart in about 10 seconds. A tractor comes and loads up the horse to dump it into a ditch. And everyone leaves, and Mondo sort of squats where the horse was and just watches the flies buzz. And I'm sitting here. The whole thing took 10 minutes. And I watched the entire ordeal. And I feel like I've just watched my own failure, like I'm a witness to my own defeat, like the family torch has been snuffed out. I didn't know what knot to tie. Thanks.
Matt Kleberg, everybody. Woo! Well, one more storyteller this evening, and then we'll turn things over to our judges. This person recently completed a third grade art project on ancient Greece, of which she is very proud. She's got a great blog called I'm gonna spell it. It's A Mominity. That's AMOMINITY.com. So check that out. Miller Murray Susan.
Hey, y'all. my mother had one career goal, which was to be a stay-at-home mom. And to that end, she had four beautiful children, of whom I am the eldest. And she really did it up. She didn't mess around. She made all our clothes. She baked bread twice a week. There was a hot homemade meal on the table at 6 p.m. every night. And when it came time for Christmas, you better believe the shit went down in our house. I mean, it was like we went to the farm and cut a tree, and then we came home and listened to Christmas carols and made paper chains, and then we made gingerbread men and we decorated them. And then, I mean, it just went on and on. She made homemade eggnog. We sang around the piano. Anyway, decorations. Woo! So, All this to say, my belief in Santa was rock solid and maintained very carefully, curated very carefully by my mom. Very invested in my belief in Santa. And so it wasn't until I was probably 9 years old in fourth grade that doubt started to creep in. I mean, nobody at school believed in Santa except for me. And I still was quite sure, based on the fact that they would make footprints coming out of the fireplace and write us notes. And, I mean, it was so perfectly done. I was like, there is no way that Santa does not exist. But I finally thought, okay, enough people have said this to me, I guess I better check in. So I pick a quiet moment with my mom, and I pull her aside, and I'm like, there is a Santa Claus, though, right? I mean, right? Like, everybody at school says no, but I told them I don't believe that because I think there is a Santa Claus. And she's like, okay, I've been waiting for this, and you're 9 years old, and I think, you know, that you're old enough and mature enough to know the truth, which is that your dad and I do Santa. Okay, we do. I'm like, she's like, yes, yes, yes. Okay, and what I need for you now to do is to help me maintain this beautiful thing that we do every Christmas for your three younger siblings. Now you're in on it, okay? And you're part of the fun. And you have to really help us keep them believing because it's so much fun for us to do and for them to believe. And I'm like, okay, all right. That sounds kind of fun, I guess. But actually, secretly, I didn't really believe her. I actually really thought maybe she was lying to me because I was totally sure there was a Santa Claus. I believed it deep in my heart. So I decided the only thing to do was to hide behind the Christmas tree and wait and see for myself what happened. So my parents did Christmas down in the living room, and they had a very, their bedroom is actually through the living room. So they had a really nice, sweet setup. And what they would do is they'd put us to bed and read us the night before Christmas. And we had that anyway. Long, elaborate ritual. And then they would go downstairs and they would tie the double doors of the living room shut with a shoelace. And then in the morning, we couldn't get in. It was tied shut. We could not get in until they came out of their bedroom fully ready to greet the day and untied the living room door. So I knew that if I wanted to figure out the Santa Claus thing once and for all, I was going to have to sneak into that living room before they tied those doors shut, which was like Mission Impossible worthy, like dunch, dunch, dun, 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 dun. But I was ready. I was ready for the challenge. So right after they read, I was like, I have to go to the bathroom. Dad's like, okay, well, go get in bed after you go. I'm like, okay, great. And then they went downstairs, and he took my mom back, and they sort of were back in their bedroom, and I was like, and I got in behind the Christmas tree, right up against the living room window, which is like a long floor-to-ceiling window, between two big boxes in the little corner. And I had done it. And I was just going to wait. I was just going to wait as long as it took to see what was going to happen next. But, you know, I hadn't really thought about the fact that it was effing freezing, which was one problem. And I was just wearing these little thin pajamas. I was sitting up against this cold window, and I was sitting there kind of like, but I'm like, it's okay, I can wait. I'm all right. And then I'm sitting there and I'm like, nothing's really happening. It's dark in there and it's kind of spooky. And I'm like, maybe this wasn't my best idea. And then right as I'm about to make a break for it, the lights come on. My dad comes in and he starts tying the door shut. So now I'm fucked. And he starts unloading all of these big brown boxes from their bedroom under their bed, and my mom's wearing her big thick glasses. My parents are arguing. She's saying things like, God damn it, Matt, didn't you buy any batteries for the goddamn radios that I bought the kids? And my dad's like, shut up, Mary, I'm so tired, I'm just trying to finish this up. She's like, damn it all, Matt, can you put together the G.I. Joe flight thing? He's like, fucking all these little fucking teeny little, Jesus Christ, fucking little bitty, God damn it, I dropped the, get the directions. And they're like bickering and shouting at each other. And it's like the least magical thing I can imagine. It's like the seamy underside of Christmas. And it's a horror show. And I'm freezing cold. And it's occurred to me at this point that I'm never getting out. And I'm going to have to sleep behind the Christmas tree. And then in the morning, I don't even know what's going to happen. Like, I'm going to, like, go out really fast and pretend to come in. Like, I can't. I just hadn't gotten that far in my thinking. Because I really thought Santa Claus was real. And I thought there'd be some magical component. And he could, like, magic me out and magic me back in the morning. So I don't mean to, but as I'm sitting there being so cold, I just move like one little, like I kind of like jerk a little, and I make a little rustly noise on the present next to me. And my dad says to this day, he's like, there's like two times in my life that all the hair on my head has stood up. But that was one of them. And he goes, Mary, what was that? And she's like, I don't know. I don't know. And he's like, there is someone in here. She's like, oh no, where? He's like, behind the Christmas tree. But it never occurred to either of them that it was one of their kids. My dad thought it was like a robber. So he goes and gets like a baseball bat. And he's coming across the room and I'm back there like. And then he's like. And he takes me by the scruff of the neck and hauls me out. And they're both aghast. My mom's like, I told you. But I told you, you already knew. What are you doing here? I'm like, I just wanted to check. I wanted to know for sure. She's like, I told you for sure. I'm like, I just didn't believe you. She's like, that's so you ruined Christmas. You've ruined it. It will never be the same. My dad's crying, and she's crying, and I'm crying. It's awful. We're all standing there, and she's like, just go to bed. Just go to bed. And don't tell your sister and your brothers. You breathe a word of this. I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry. But that wasn't true, because I ran right upstairs and woke my sister up and told her everything. I still don't know what made me do that. I think I just felt so horrible. I had to share my horribleness. It was too much horribleness to endure. I had to spew it all over somebody else. So I woke her up and I was like, Mom and Dad are Santa. I just saw them. They put out all the presents. She's like, rawr, rawr. Anyway, so now I'm a parent myself. And I have an 8-year-old girl. And she has seemed very invested. But just this year when she wrote her Santa letter, she asked Santa for his autograph and left a little line for the autograph. So I have a feeling that means that doubt is creeping in. And you better believe that if I tell her the truth, I will be watching to make sure she's in bed before I put out the presents.
Millimore Susan, everybody. Woo! Yay! Cool. Actually, I'm gonna tell a story as well while we're waiting for Jen's gonna go around and collect the ballots. So I'm gonna tell one more. When I was 10 years old, my dad was leaving for work really early one morning. It was during a thunderstorm, and my family, we were all in what we called the family room. It was our den. My mom was near the kitchen, and my older brother Brett, he was near the front window. And my baby brother was in the playpen, and I was kind of near the back, near the table. And then there was this incredibly bright flash of lightning, and simultaneously this horrendous, huge boom of thunder. And we heard this horrific scream, this agonizing human scream. And my brother and my mom ran outside, and I ran outside. And my dad was lying in the grass beside the driveway. And his black umbrella was open. It was about 12 feet away in the front yard. And then there was this chaos. My mom ran next door to get Mr. Anderson, and a car pulled up with Mrs. Burris, who was my carpool. And the adults picked up my dad and put him in the back of this hatchback. And my mom got in the back, and they drove away slowly along this road that swept out towards the front of our house. And she was in the back leaning over him to shelter him. And this, I'm thinking, this is great because now I'm going to get to visit him in the hospital. And my older brother had been to the hospital to have his tonsils out, but I had never been to the hospital before. I'm very excited. And this is, in keeping with our theme tonight, sort of, I guess, our sort of redneck theme, I think. This is upstate South Carolina. It's a small town. So within half an hour or something, there are these neighbors and their relatives, all these people from our church that have shown up at our house. And they're in the kitchen, and they bring food. And then they're kind of milling in the family room as well. And I go into my older brother's room, Brett, and I ask Brett, you know, and he says that that dad will be fine because he was grounded. And electricity can't hurt you if you're grounded. And he was 12, so he was sort of an expert to me. And he also had an Erector set, which made him even more of an expert on things. And I went back into the living room, and for some reason in this crowded house, no one happened to be in there. So I sat down, it was kind of dark, the lights weren't on, and outside there was a picture window. You know, I remember how gray it was with the sky overcast. And a car pulled up, and my mom got out. And so I run out and up to her, and I said, "How's Dad, and when are we going to get to visit him in the hospital?" And she just put her hand around me, and she didn't say anything. And she started walking me back to the house, and that's when I knew he was dead. And 3 years later, we moved to Charlottesville. And 10 years after that, I had a house. Oh, 20 years, I'm sorry. 20 years after that, I had a house in Belmont. And a couple years after that, my baby brother, now grown up, gone to college, graduated from college, been in Boston for a year, he came to live with me in my house. And he was going to help me pay mortgage, and he didn't know what to do next, so he was going to try to figure out where he was going next while I was staying there. My brother is sometimes named Ben. He has different names. I say sometimes because he never really liked the name Ben, so he changes his name. But I don't think he's ever been able to settle in any of the replacement names, so he keeps changing it. And and he also has this mischievous streak. He's kind of sneaky. So once I found out, he springs these name changes on you in surprising ways. Once I found out this way, I was at his house, and he said, "Oh, by the way, I got interviewed in the newspaper." And he shows me this newspaper. I pick it up, and there he is with a different name. That's how I found out. And he's got this sort of a sneaky look in his eye while he's handing it to me, you know, like this. So anyway, when he was staying with me at the house, we would sit on the front porch back then, and we would both chain smoke, because that's what we did. And we would tell stories. And since he was 6 months old when his dad died, I would sometimes tell him stories about his dad. And once I told him the story that I just told you, the story about him dying. And when I told him this, because I told the story a lot, one thing nice about having your dad die in a violent or horrible way is it's easy, people are interested in it, and it's easy to share it. So it's easier to get over it than if they had been died by, you know, if your dad dies like getting electrocuted while he's masturbating or something, you're not going to, it's gonna be hard to get over. But when it's something like, you know, horrible, but in an open way that people are allowed to share, like being struck by lightning, everyone's interested. So I was sharing this with him, and I realized that in the middle of the story, I disappear. And I thought about that, how in the middle of the story, we all run outside, and then there was nothing about me, and I'd always told the story that way. And I realized the reason I told the story that way is how ashamed I was. And I was ashamed because I hadn't done anything. You know, all the adults were doing stuff. I didn't do anything. My dad is lying there, like 10 feet away on the ground. I remember me standing there and our eyes meeting and that look of him sort of disappearing almost. And I didn't do anything. I didn't run up to him. I didn't console him. I just, you know, stood there like as a 10-year-old with my mouth open. There wasn't any of that kind of like, you know, dramatic sort of like, "Dearest Father, do not forsake us. Do not abandon us to our fate. We who love you, hold on, hold on. Son, although I may be passing now into the celestial great beyond, know that my spirit will always be with you to comfort you and guide you." It wasn't like that at all. Instead, it was a 10-year-old with his mouth open. So this man, who was a wonderful person, the last sight, one of his last sights on earth, was me standing there going, looking at him like he was horrible. And I always felt so ashamed, and he was a good man, and I knew he understood, and he would forgive me for that. But somehow I wanted him to know that I knew that he would forgive me for that. When I'm telling my brother this story, I realize all this, and I share it with him. And my brother, later on, a couple months later, did figure out what he wanted to do next with his life. He met a woman who graduated from UVA, and they fell in love, and he went down to Georgia to meet her family. That's where they were from. And while he was gone, I had this lucid dream. It's the only time I've ever had what they call lucid dreams. And I was asleep on the couch in the afternoon, and which I do a lot because I'm lazy. And so I'm sleeping on this couch, and I have this incredible vivid dream in which I'm asleep on the couch. And everything's exactly like it really is, except my dad is there. And he floats up, and he's standing there at the foot of the bed, and he says, "I know." And I said, well, and it was kind of awkward, but I said, "Well, I know, but I just want you to know that I know that you know." And he said, "I know." And that was the dream. That was it. And so a few days later, about a week later, my brother comes back, and we're sitting on the front porch and was chain smoking, and he's telling me about his trip, and he mentions that on the way to Georgia he actually stopped in that small town because he hadn't been there hardly at all since he was born there, and just to check it out. And I said, well, that's interesting, because I just had this dream, and I told him the dream, the same dream I just told all of you. And he gets that sneaky look in his eye, and he says, what day did that happen? And I said, it was Thursday. And he says, yes, Thursday, actually I went to the town, and we found where the graveyard was, and I found the grave, and I knelt down there, and I asked Dad to let you know that he'd forgiven you. Thanks, everybody. Merry Christmas. Yay! I want to let you know, I'm Joel Jones. My co-host here is Jennifer Jones. And our sound person is Jennifer Jones tonight. We also have people in the door. Christine and Emily work in the door. Thank you. Our sound keeper, first one was... Dave and Rose. Okay, cool. Dave was here before, and Rose is here right now. Thank you, both of them. Yay. Thank you so much to Mateus and to the people here at Motos, Black Market Motos Saloon, for letting us come do this. Please tip them and come here and drink more, whether we're here or not. And now we see. Oh, thank you so much for the judges. And we have a winner. I missed the poll. I was like, where's the winner written here? The winner of the Big Blue Door Jam. There's Matt Clayburgh. A victory by a first timer. What? It was very close. It was a tie. Cool. Awesome. Yeah. Thanks so much. And all of you come back in January 17th. What? Our upcoming themes, yeah. You can also go to bigbluedoor.org, sign up either to take a class or to sign up to do a story here. Our next theme in January is journeys. February is jealousy and envy. March is books, and that's going to be back at the bridge in March for sure. Anyway, thank you all once again for coming out. What night.